Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. We're here for oral argument in our case number 1CASA 260211 Sullivan v. Sullivan. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed, and so we ask counsel to please identify yourself and your clients at the beginning and your client at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant's counsel is responsible for watching the clock to reserve a portion if you'd like for rebuttal. Also, please keep in mind that we've read the briefs, we've conferenced the case this morning, and with that, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Alex Sandlin, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, John Sullivan. Regardless of whether we apply Alaska or Arizona law here, a bigamous marriage is considered void ab initio at the beginning when the parties contracted into the purported marriage. Here, under Arizona law, we look to first whether the marriage was valid in the place it was contracted.
Before we get there, can I interject and ask you a question about the appeal in Division 2?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the heart of the legal issues on appeal in Division 2 the same as the heart of the issue that we have here?
Yes, Your Honor. We are challenging the denial of the motion to set aside in the appeal in Division 2. The problem we faced and why we filed this second special action, which we recognize in our petition, is because now there is also a contempt finding based on that erroneous denial of the motion to set aside. And as this court and Division 2 has recognized, the only way that a party can challenge a contempt finding is via special action relief, which necessitated the second petition for special action being filed in this case.
If the appeal in Division 2 were to come out your way on this core legal question of the validity of the marriage, and we hadn't spoken yet, would that resolve the contempt issue, or would it still need to be resolved via this special action because of the nature of a contempt finding?
I believe now that the contempt ruling has been entered under 78C, it's a final appealable order. Other proceedings would need to occur to challenge the underlying contempt finding. Okay. And so there's no hard and fast rule. There might be other ways in the trial court to challenge that, but the most direct way to challenge that is to file a special action challenging it.
And my understanding is that the purge deadline is tomorrow, and there's a return hearing set for later this month at which, barring a purge payment, there's an expectation of incarceration?
Yes, Your Honor. The purge is due tomorrow. We have filed a motion to stay in the trial court. The response was filed last night, and that has not been ruled on as of yet. And then there is a hearing later this month.
Is that stay process in the Superior Court, the ongoing stay request process, is that why you have not sought a stay from us?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. It has not been ruled on. Once that's ruled on, if it's denied, then we would be seeking a stay in this court to allow the court to issue a decision in the special action.
Okay. Are there any issues in the Division II appeal that are different or bigger, I guess, for lack of a better word? Is it more encompassing?
No, the only issues are the enforcement and contempt of the spousal maintenance, and then that it should have been set aside as a void order.
Okay.
Let me ask, does this court have the authority to sua sponte, stay the contempt proceeding pending Division 2 resolving that appeal?
I believe the court has authority to stay the underlying trial court proceedings, yes. I think we would still run into the issue as contempt is only appealable through special action, and so that would cause an issue with how can he challenge the contempt finding through the appeal process.
But if it was stayed, it just didn't, there was no movement on it until you have almost the answer, which is whether or not he should be held in contempt. That you could still challenge it at that later time, and you'd have a decision from Division 2, right?
Well, so he has been found in contempt. We have an order stating he has been found in contempt. This is just the purge and whether or not he's paid that and whether he should be incarcerated or not.
But if we stayed all of that until we heard from Division Two, would either party be in a worse off position? Is there any benefit to having almost two bites at the apple here?
And we have requested a stay of the Division II appeal while this case is ongoing. We're certainly not trying to go to two courts to see who gives us the better result.
Which was filed first? This special action or the Division II appeal?
The Division II appeal was filed first. It was then stayed because there was no final order under 78B or C in the trial court. Then the trial court entered the order finding our client in contempt, and that was the order that was entered under Rule 78. And at that point, we filed a notice in Division 2 saying that there had been a final order entered, but we have requested that that be stayed since this court was holding oral argument and briefing on this special action.
And I would guess that the record on appeal is fuller than the record we have here in the special action.
There would be additional pleadings, I believe, we have provided, for the issues in this case. I believe we provided all of the appropriate pleadings for this court to fully consider the record. In the response to the petition, I don't believe any other documents were presented that we wouldn't have attached to our petition. And so I don't think we've left anything out. It's a fairly straightforward case of there's been a couple petitions to enforce, there was a consent decree, and then there's been the briefing practice that we attached to our petition for special action.
Is the underlying motion between Ms. Sullivan and Randy, her husband, that the nunk-pro-tunk order involves, or ex-husband, is there a joint motion? It's not in our record.
The motion
to the Alaska court. I know we have the nunk-pro-tunk order, but the motion I didn't see in the exhibits or the attachments to the petition for special action.
Motion that would have been filed in 2014?
Correct.
To my knowledge, I do not believe that's in the record before the Superior Court.
Is it in the record before Division II?
I don't believe so.
So to shift to that 2014 nunk-pro-tunk order, just to confirm, the order doesn't say anything about this being the equivalent of a Rule 60B6 relief. The relief that the court granted there to Randy and Kathy was solely on its nunk-pro-tunk authority.
Yes, Your Honor. And the decree was attached to the petition for special action. And you can see that on Appendix 63. The court stated that it was essentially unfamiliarity with the legal procedure, a mistake of fact. They both just thought the court was going to enter a judgment at the hearing that neither of them attended. And since they were unfamiliar with the legal process, they said they just assumed it had been entered and that nothing else was needed from them.
Well, the order also says that the interest of justice would be served, right? It wasn't just a mistake of fact. The court also found that the interest of justice would be served by issuing the nunk-pro-tunk order.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's part of the language in nunk-pro-tunk orders. It's when the interests of justice require it. However, the court is still limited, and the law on nunk-pro-tunk orders in both Alaska and Arizona is fairly identical. A nunk-pro-tunk order is what the court intended to do at the time. Here, the facts are generally undisputed that the parties filed a petition in Alaska, or Randy and Kathy filed a petition in Alaska in 1996, I believe. And there was a hearing set for February of 1997. Nobody appeared at the hearing. There is no testimony or evidence that the court rendered a judgment during that hearing that they were supposed to appear at. There's no evidence that anything was issued that the court signed that day. They didn't appear, and then eventually the case was dismissed due to inactivity.
It was dismissed through the clerk's office in 1999, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the court never issued an order dismissing it?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Are there, I know that the Fairbanks case is the case that you primarily rely on for nunk-pro-tunk issues in Alaska. Are there any other cases that maybe you didn't cite in your brief that you brought with you today that addresses that in Alaska?
So the Fairbanks case does cite to two other cases discussing nunk-pro-tunk orders in Alaska. It's footnote 15 and 16, the Peterson v. Swarthout case and the Isaacson Structural Steel Co. Cases. And the reasoning in those cases also lines up with Arizona's law on nunk-pro-tunk orders. It's what the court intended to do then, that for an oversight, a clerical mistake, was not entered.
But whether it lines up with Arizona law or not that's of no importance to us. We just care what the Alaska law is, correct?
I would agree, Your Honor, but I think if they are similar, then the reasoning of the Arizona court could be, you know, supportive of, you know, the reasoning of the Alaska courts in the nunk-pro-tunk cases. And that's where, you know, we look to the Mallett case and the Hashes Estate case, to the limited circumstances where divorce decrees in Arizona have been allowed to be entered nunk-pro-tunk to a prior date. Because as far as I've been able to find, that issue has not come up under Alaska case law. And in both of those cases, it was a very different factual situation. The parties in Mallett, they attended a hearing. The court rendered a judgment on the record, and then the form of the judgment, the actual entry of the judgment, did not occur until a later date. And so when the judgment had been rendered as of the date of the hearing, the court in Mallett found it appropriate to retroactively enter it back to the date it had been rendered. And that was the same situation in Hash's Estate, which was an odd case. I compare it to Marriage of Fong. In that case, the Superior Court judges had signed the decrees, had rendered the judgments in those divorces. And back then, apparently the lawyers got to keep the divorce decrees, and they had to go file them with the clerk to have them entered in those cases. And the lawyer in Hash's Estate had held on to these signed divorce decrees and hadn't submitted them to the court for it to collect payment, or there was some evidence someone might not have wanted him to send it to the clerk's office. But in both of those circumstances, the courts found it appropriate to enter it nunk-pro-tunk because the judgment had been rendered. And I think that's the important distinction here. There was no judgment rendered on February 10th of 1997.
Was it a consent decree? Was it scheduled to be a consent hearing?
I'm not sure how the Alaska court had characterized.
Was there a decree prepared or submitted by Kathy and Randy to the court in 1996 or 1997 that the court later endorsed? Like in 2014, was there, because we don't have the decree. Was there a decree that was submitted to the court?
I don't believe that is in the record, whether or not a decree had been submitted. The 2014 divorce decree is attached to the petition for special action.
That's the decree?
Yes. That
There's
is the
no
only
other
decree that was ever signed. And it was signed as of June of 2014. There was never an order signed in 1997 when the hearing took place.
And we don't know if one was prepared for signature.
I do not know that, Your Honor.
Are you aware of any other state that has authorized the use of a nunk-pro-tunk order beyond sort of Arizona and Alaska? I guess what I'm really asking is, are we two outlier states, or are we sort of consistent, that the consistent use is with the text of what nunk-pro-tunk means, i.e. this is not a substantive later change, it is to represent what actually occurred.
From my view of case law, it seems fairly consistent that nunk-pro-tunk is just, it's a clerical oversight, it's inadvertence on behalf of either the judge or the clerk's office, where it should have been entered, but it wasn't. It's not a mistake of the parties because they didn't show up for their hearing and the case got dismissed. I'm unaware of any case law that would allow a nunk pro tunk judgment to be entered back to the retroactive date 2 decades later in that situation. And I really think that is the crux of this case. Can a court nunk pro tunk render and enter a judgment back to a date nearly 2 decades prior? Because it's undisputed. No one showed up for this hearing. There was never a judgment signed by the court at that time. The case just sat for 2 years until the clerk's office eventually dismissed it.
Does equity play any role in our analysis of affording full faith and credit to an Alaska order, to this Alaska order?
In this situation, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the attack on this judgment is that it's void. John was not a party to the divorce between Kathy and Randy. He had no ability to know whether or not there was a decree entered. He didn't know she was married when they got married.
Is the record clear on when each of these three individuals figured out that there was no valid decree? I wasn't sure we could pin that down in terms of Kathy, Randy, and John's coming to this realization. Obviously, Randy did at some point in or before 2014 because that's when they sought the change. But is there anything else in the record that we have in front of us that confirms knowledge?
The record is unclear as to when exactly everyone learned of it. I believe the court in its ruling found that John learned in, I believe it was 2022, that Kathy had been married and that she hadn't gotten a divorce from Randy. I believe in the motion practice that Kathy stated that she learned in 2014 about that the divorce had not been finalized in Alaska. But going back to Your Honor's question, when it's a void judgment, I don't believe equity comes into play. A judgment is either void or valid. A party can wait an unreasonable amount of time to attack a void judgment. A party can consent to a void judgment and later attack that same judgment. If it's a void judgment, which in this case, spousal maintenance cannot be awarded if there is no marriage, the court has to set that aside as void, regardless of the equities of the case. In the situation of Mallett, I think the court focused on it because in that case, the judgment had been rendered. And so looking at should we retroactively enter it as of the date of rendering, in that limited situation, I believe the court there found it equity was a consideration, but here when no judgment has been rendered, then it's just, is it void or is it valid? And unless there's further questions, I'd like to save my last couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is PJ Judd, and I represent the respondent in this case, Kathy Sullivan.
So can we, before you get into your argument, ask you some of the same questions we asked your colleague? Do you agree that the crux of the heart of the issues on appeal in Division II,
yes,
the legal issues are the same legal issue here?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the crux of this case turns on whether the lower court got it right when it declined to when it denied the motion to set aside. That's what I understand to be before the appellate court in Division II.
Did you oppose the stay requested in the
yes.
trial court? Why?
Because my reading of Arizona case law as it concerns contempt is it is not up to the individual under the order law to decline to refuse to comply with the expectation that it's going to be overturned. In fact, I cite a case in my brief State v. Chavez that states the concept that any person, lay professional, may determine whether a court order is void on its face and thus susceptible to being ignored as unconstitutional can find no justification
in the law. So that's an argument about the merits, obviously, of the party's position, but why would you oppose a stay as opposed to the proceeding of two cases in two courts with the same legal issue?
Because my understanding of the way that case law and Arizona law concerning contempt is, if he violated a law at the time that it was enforced, then he's in contempt. His best course of action would have been to comply with the law until it was overturned on appeal, not choose to disregard the law for 9 months, holding out hopes for a favorable ruling.
Is either party prejudiced or harmed in any way if this court were to stay the contempt issue raised here to allow Division II to address the legal merits that are raised? Is either party harmed by that?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe my client is harmed by that decision because the order that petitioner chose to ignore was the same order that she relied on to live. She's in her late 70s, early 80s. She has Social Security and very little else. And so she's been fighting for recovery for well over a year, taking out debt and doing everything that she could to make this go forward. The Superior Court decided to go forward with the trial for contempt. She expended the resources to go forward with the trial and contempt in reliance that she would recover. She was ordered a recovery. The deadline for that recovery is in 2 days. There is a massive disparity in income. Petitioner earns about six figures. She doesn't even make minimum wage. And so her ability to continue through this case as it goes through the Court of Appeals is going to be largely dictated by her recovery on based on the lower court's order.
Okay.
Do I understand your argument, your substantive argument on the nunk-pro-tunk issue to be an equitable argument? In other words, sort of whatever the Fairbanks case says about the limitations of a nunk-pro-tunk order, it's not fair recognize it.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you, Your Honor. No, Your Honor, it's legal and equitable. The Fairbanks case, from my reading of it, said that clerical errors were an example of mistakes that could be corrected by nunk-pro-tunk, but it the language says such as clerical errors. Such as doesn't limit the relief that the court can give, the mistakes that can be corrected by nunk-pro-tunk to clerical errors. It's just one of the ways that the court can correct mistakes.
What's your best legal authority to support the position that a judgment that was never issued can be issued nunk-pro-tunk? A substantive judgment. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Your Honor. Looks like I'm having a hard time timing when you guys finish your questions. Hash is a state. The resemblance and the similarities between...
That's an Arizona case, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And similar to my colleague, I was unable to find any Alaska case authority that deals with this specific issue. The closest thing I could find was Arizona authority, and I thought Hash's estate was
I want to give you a chance to describe your perspective on Hash's estate, but before we leave Fairbanks, while I understand your point that it says that courts may appropriately use this power to correct mistakes such as clerical errors, the following sentence is, but the entry nunk-pro-tunk cannot be used by the lower court as a device to amend a judgment which properly reflected the decision of the court but which was later found to be undesirable or erroneous. I have trouble getting past that language because it is my understanding that although it was a clerk's office dismissal, the clerk's office dismissal of the petition for divorce decree in Alaska properly reflected the decision at the time because the parties failed to show. How is that not determinative in the Fairbanks case? And then if you want to proceed to discuss Hash's estate, that's fine.
My reading of that case, I viewed the failure of either party to show up to the hearing as a mutual mistake of fact. Both parties thought that the case was going, or that their divorce was going to be granted. Both of them thought, apparently, that the other side was going to show up. And so my reading of nunk-pro-tunk as something to that can be used to correct mistakes, I thought that was one of the mistakes. I mean, going, and this is where my reading of Hash's influenced the, my view of the case. The parties affected by the decrees that the attorney passed away holding had never seen their decrees. They, you know, they'd never read their decrees, and yet they moved on with their lives. They got married. One could even say it was irresponsible. In fact, the case...
But did Hash's estate turn on the actions or the beliefs of the parties or what had actually occurred in the court at the time of the divorce? In other words, the judgment was rendered there. It just wasn't filed. So it, maybe you could point me to where I'm misunderstanding, but is there something in that case that was it the parties' own beliefs or conduct was determinative of the court's, the subsequent nunk-pro-tunk ruling?
I didn't see the conduct of the parties as being determinative. I just, I viewed the conduct of the parties as being one of the things that the court considered. Basically, the court's, from my reading of the case, the court's decision to issue those decrees nunk-pro-tunk turned on turned on equity. They were having to decide between the black letter of the law, which would require that those decrees not be entered, or equity. And they brought up the possibility of numerous parties waking up to find that their marriages were valid, that they were that they had unknowingly committed bigamy, and that the court looked at those two alternatives, and it was a close decision. There was a dissent pointing the other way, but the court reluctantly granted the nunk-pro-tunk order to prevent that. And those are the same sort of equitable considerations that are present in this case. At the time that the Sullivans were married, Ms. Sullivan believed that she was single and that she was free to marry Mr. Sullivan. They had an entire marriage in which there is no allegation on the record that I have seen that her conduct or her behavior as a wife was in any way influenced or diminished by the unfinished dissolution. They divorced prior to the dissolution even being granted. And so that marriage lived its natural lifespan, which I believe Arizona public policy, the reason for Arizona's position on bigamy is that it destroys marriages. But there's a knowing element involved. The criminal statute for bigamy requires that a party
just to
know.
Confirm. Is it your perspective that we are to apply Arizona substantive law, or are you using this as persuasive authority for how
we? I'm using this as persuasive authority because I could not find any Alaskan authority except for the trial judge's own actions that speak to this issue directly. The only cases I could find where nunk-pro-tunk was used with these sorts of equitable considerations were the cases that we've discussed, Hashes and then Mallet v. Mallet. And in both instances, particularly Mallet v. Mallet, you know, with Mallet v. Mallet, things happened when they happened, but the court decided to apply nunk-pro-tunk because it valued was opposed to a party escaping accountability for spousal maintenance through annulment. Well, that's precisely what's going on in this case. The order for spousal maintenance was rendered in 2012. Counsel's best estimation of when Mr. Sullivan became aware of the failure of the Alaska dissolution and 2014 nunk-pro-tunk order was 2022. He'd been paying spousal maintenance for 10 years, just assuming that his divorce was just like any other. And upon it wasn't until he found that out that he first decided that he was no longer going to comply with the order. And when she threatened to, when my client threatened to seek court intervention, that's when he filed to set the order aside. And so I think that his interest in setting this marriage aside is purely to avoid responsibility for spousal maintenance.
What is your do you have a limiting principle? Like, if we were to say the marriage is valid, how long after the marriage can a nunk-pro-tunk reach back? 5 years, 40 years? Do you have any limiting principle on this equitable argument?
I don't think that the span of time is as important as the circumstances that surround the initial attempt to get divorced. The Alaskan court made findings that both of the parties filed in 96. The appearance of party could have been waived, and either both of them thought that the other attended. And in this case, both parties remarried, assuming that the divorce had been granted. I think that that's a critical fact in this case, that both parties were under the impression that everything was tied up and they were free to move on.
Do we have the written statements from Randy and Kathy that were submitted to the Alaska court? Is that in the record before us?
No, the only my colleague, the only things that I have seen from the Alaskan case are the findings of the court and then the entry of the decree. But I thought that the findings of that case were basically put that particular Superior Court judge's considerations right in line with the considerations that the Court of Appeals considered when in Hash's estate, which is, here we have, by mutual mistake of fact, a couple of people that have moved on, remarried, thinking that their last divorce was finalized. There's no harm coming from that mistake of fact. It's not as though one of them has knowledge and is secretly funneling community funds.
What's our standard of review of the nunk-pro-tunk order? Is it de novo or is it for an abuse of discretion?
I believe it's de novo, Your Honor, but I could be mistaken.
Could you confirm for me your understanding of the current status of the appeal in Division II? I'm understanding that it's live and under consideration. There was a period of stay, but it's been reinstated as of May and proceeding forward. But am I mistaken about that?
My understanding is that it is proceeding forward, but a stay has been requested
and is pending before the court. I did not object to the stay before the Court of Appeals.
A stay because of this special action or a stay?
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding being that this action had to go forward contempt to be contested, and the only way to oppose contempt is through special action.
Is there a calendar date for the panel in Division II to conference the case or discuss the case or oral argument set or any dates that you're aware?
Your Honor, there are no dates set yet. And if Your Honors have no further questions, can I save my last 3 minutes for rebuttal?
So we don't normally do rebuttal for you.
Oh, okay.
Rebuttal for appellant. So, nice. Yeah, you can use it now, though. Let me ask you a question that I raised to your colleague. Is there anything in the record that suggests Alaska Civil Rule 60 was ever invoked or cited or as part of the nunk-pro-tunk request?
I have not seen anything in the record to suggest that. Then I thank Your Honors for your time.
Thank you. Looks like you have a little under 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
And if I could ask you to start with clarifying, I'm not sure we got the precision, or at least I didn't understand. What stays have you requested from whom and of what?
So we have requested a stay of the continuing contempt proceedings in the trial court. We've also requested a stay of the appeal in Division II. And I did want to clarify.
And both of those remain unresolved?
Yes, Your
Honor.
No briefs have been filed in Division II. No opening brief, nothing. That had to be stayed because there was no final order entered. Then the contempt order was entered under Rule 78. That appeal then started pending again. But we would have had to request a stay or a continuance in any event because there's been no fee award from the contempt ruling yet.
I see.
So nothing's been briefed in Division II at this time. The only briefing has occurred in this court. I'd also note if the court did want to stay the proceedings to allow the Division II case to go forward, our only concern would be that the spousal maintenance order would still be in play. The monthly obligation would still be going forward on what we believe is a void order. There's a question as to whether the court can stay a spousal maintenance order, but we would also want that stayed so that there weren't additional enforcement proceedings or collection proceedings.
Why would we have to stay the spousal maintenance order if we're staying the incarceration or the purge date? If you were successful in Division II on the appeal, that would wipe out any spousal maintenance, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. But as his monthly obligation continues to accrue, there can be additional proceedings going on in the trial court for enforcement for collection of the amounts that continue to move forward. Even if he's not, the contempt order itself is stayed, the underlying obligation would remain in effect on what we believe is a void spousal maintenance order. I did want to note Alaska has, and we've cited in our briefs, the statute that states that bigamous marriages are void. There is a way under Alaskan law where once the impediment of the prior marriage is removed, the parties can continue to be married and the statute specifically states...
Go quickly, because your time's up.
Yes. That they are legally married as of the date of the impediment. If a nunk-pro-tunk order were permitted to retroactively issue a divorce decree years prior, this would essentially render that language under the statute just meaningless.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your briefs and your argument here today. We'll take the matter under advisement. We have to issue something quickly, it sounds like. But to appellant, as soon as you hear from the trial court on the pending stay, will you please notify the court one way or the other what the Superior Court does with that? Okay, thank you. We're adjourned.